Our sermon passage this morning is from James 5, so turn with me to the book of James. James 5, verses 7 through 11. Be patient, therefore, brothers, until the coming of the Lord. See how the farmer waits for the precious fruit of the earth, being patient about it until it receives the early and the late rains. You also be patient. Establish your hearts, for the coming of the Lord is at hand. Do not grumble against one another, brothers, so that you may not be judged. Behold, the judge is standing at the door. As an example of suffering and patience, brothers, take the prophets who spoke in the name of the Lord. Behold, we consider those blessed who remain steadfast. You have heard of the steadfastness of Job, and you have seen the purpose of the Lord, how the Lord is compassionate and merciful.
Well, this morning we continue our sermon series in the book of James, and as we do, we're nearing the end. And so after this morning, we have 3 weeks left. And so I'm preaching verses 7 through 11 this morning. If you have an ESV, or if you remember, we're following just kind of the paragraph divisions in the ESV Bible. So I've got verses 7 through 11 this morning. Brett Haynes is preaching next week. Wow. On verse 12. Then Jared is preaching verse 13 through 18. And then I'm going to be preaching verse 19 and then also verse 20. And then I believe it's October the 1st. My calendar might be wrong in my mind. We're starting a new sermon series in the book of, you need to come to our members meeting next Sunday afternoon at 4 o'clock in order to find out. So anyway, just a little plug for that. We're going to keep it a surprise. Sorry. So, in saying all that, I know it's been a while since we began this sermon series. I think it was about 4.5 months ago, almost 5 months. Does anybody remember, you don't have to say this out loud, but does anybody remember kind of the initial reason, the main reason that we gave for why we chose the book of James to preach through? We talked about it during that first sermon series, kind of the introduction, talked about it for the first few weeks especially, kind of the main reason why we as elders chose the book of James to preach through. So at that time, 4.5, 5 months ago, Jared and I, and then also Bill, I'm going to throw Bill under the bus because he was an elder at the time, we're not like the sharpest tools in the shed, right? And so our logic for picking James kind of went something like this. James is writing to believers that are suffering. We have a whole lot of people in our church who are suffering. So let's preach through James. That was kind of the logic. Or to say it another way, during that time, we'd been meeting a lot with different people who were suffering in the life of our church or walking through trials in the life of our church at that time, 4.5, 5 months ago, and a lot of the counsel that we were giving, one of the main books that we were pointing people to at that time, who were walking through trials and suffering in their lives, one of the main books we were pointing people to, chapters and verses that we were pointing people to during that time were found in the book of James. And so then it's been almost 5 months ago since we started this book, and guess what? Going through James didn't just somehow make all the trials that people were walking through in our church disappear. Didn't make just all the suffering that people were enduring at that time, 4.5, 5 months ago, just all of a sudden we go through James and their suffering, your suffering just vanishes. Instead, if you fast forward 4.5, 5 months later, today, then we still have a whole lot of people suffering and walking through trials in the life of our church. Probably more than we had 4.5, 5 months ago when we started this book. People who are facing hard difficulties, hard circumstances in their lives. And oftentimes, though, this is when Walking through suffering is the most challenging and most difficult, isn't it? It's not necessarily when suffering first initially begins. Like that first initial sting, that first initial jolt, that first initial encounter with that trial or suffering in our lives. Like, that's hard, don't get me wrong. But oftentimes what's harder is when that suffering lingers, when it continues, like day after day after day after day, with no sign or sight whatsoever of that suffering that we're walking through ever ending. And that day becomes a month, and that month becomes a year, and that year becomes 5 years, and 5 years becomes 15 years, and 15 years becomes 30 years, and it's still there. Like, that's when suffering is oftentimes the most challenging, the most difficult. It's not that initial boom. And that's hard, don't get me wrong. I don't want to minimize that. But it's when that pain and hurt and tears don't ever stop. It's like the new norm. It's become just what life is. And that's the case for what we're going to see within this passage here this morning. That, remember who James is writing to, right? He's writing to Jewish Christians who've recently been displaced from their homes because of persecution. And now they're being exploited and oppressed by rich, wealthy landowners. And so suffering has been going on for quite some time in their lives. Trials have been going on for a long time in their lives. Like, life is hard. Life is difficult in their lives. And where they find themselves right now, there's no end in sight. They can't, if you remember from last week, they can't defend themselves against those who are oppressing them. There's no, they just have to sit there and take it. And so from their vantage point, there's no way of escape. There's no deliverance. There's no way out of the trial and the suffering that they're facing in their lives. They just have to grin and bear it. It's just what life is going to be like for the rest of their lives. And in light of that, then, James writes this particular passage to these suffering believers, to encourage them and to comfort them and to bring them hope in the midst of the suffering that they're walking through, that there seems to be no end. And the one word, you probably noticed this when Mallory was reading this passage, the one word that he brings up over and over and over again to these suffering believers is the word patience. Don't you hate that word? Patience. You might want to underline or circle every time the word patience, patient, wait, steadfast, and steadfastness are used within these verses. Right? Just underline or circle these in your Bible. Verse 7, we see the word patient right from the get-go there. In the middle of verse 7, we see the word wait. At the end of verse 7, again, we see the word patient. In verse 8, begins with the word patient. In verse 10, we see the word patience. In verse 11, we see the word steadfast and steadfastness. And so then, do you think, like, James might be trying to communicate something to us here? Like, when suffering, when trials linger in our lives, there seems to be no sign of those sufferings ever leaving, then we need patience. We need steadfastness. Which is hard, isn't it? Like, I don't know about you, but I don't like to wait for anything. I don't like to wait in line at the grocery store. I don't like to wait in traffic. I don't like to wait 2 seconds for that website to come up after I click that link. Like, if it takes longer than 2 seconds, I'm moving on. Like, waiting is hard. But this is James' encouragement. This is James' exhortation of how we, how his readers, and how we are to respond to this ongoing suffering and trials in our lives that linger, that continue, that seem to never end. How are we supposed to respond? We're to wait. We're to be patient. We're to be steadfast. Which then begs the question, well, nice, but how do you do that? How do you patiently wait in the midst of suffering? How do you patiently endure suffering in your life? What's that look like? What's that consist of? How do you do that? Well, that's what we're going to see in our passage here this morning. What James is going to do within our passage, he's going to give us 4 ways to patiently endure ongoing, lingering suffering in our lives. Four ways to endure, 4 ways to persevere, to patiently endure suffering in our lives that seem to never end. And as we see these 4 ways, I pray that this would be an encouragement to you. Especially if you're in this room right now and you're in the midst of suffering right now, you're in the midst of trials right now that have been lingering in your life, then I pray that these 4 ways that we see would be a great encouragement, that they would give you hope and comfort in the midst of the suffering, the trials that you're walking through even right now. And so then here's the first way. See this on your handout here, but here's the first way that James gives us to patiently endure suffering in our lives. It's this. It's by patiently waiting for the Lord's return. Patiently waiting for the Lord's return. That's what James says right from the very get-go there in verse 7. Look there with me at the very beginning of verse 7. James says this. He says, "Be patient, therefore, brothers, until the coming of the Lord." The key word right here in verse 7 at the very beginning there is the word therefore. And the reason it's the key word is because the word therefore ties what James is about to say in verse 7 with what he just said in verses 1 through 6. And so then, if you remember, in verses 1 through 6 from last week, he talked about, and this is kind of a summary of what we saw in verses 1 through 6 and what he says there, he talked about how the Lord is going to come and judge these rich, wealthy landowners who are oppressing and defrauding the Jewish Christians that he's writing to. The Lord is going to come in judgment against these rich, wealthy landowners who are oppressing these Jewish Christians that he's writing to. Therefore, everybody with me? In light of that, since that's true, here's how these Jewish Christians who are suffering are to respond. Verse 7, be patient, therefore, until the coming of the Lord. This phrase there, the coming of the Lord there, it's a phrase we see all throughout the Bible, especially all throughout the New Testament, specifically in reference to when Jesus returns back to this earth a second time. And that when he returns, he's going to do 2 things when he returns, when he comes a second time. First, he's going to judge the wicked. He's going to judge the wicked, like these wealthy landowners who are oppressing and defrauding these Jewish Christians. He's going to come in judgment against them. But secondly, he's going to come for deliverance. He's going to come and rescue and deliver the righteous. He's going to come and deliver and rescue all those who've placed their faith in Jesus, like these suffering Jewish Christians that he's writing to. Not only that, though, but that title Lord there in verse 7, it's a reference to, it references back to verse 4 of chapter 5 when James mentioned the Lord of hosts. If you remember there, the Lord of hosts could literally be translated as the Lord of armies. And that title is used over and over again all throughout the Old Testament to depict God as a mighty warrior who is leading this vast army to judge the wicked people who are oppressing his people. So God is this mighty warrior coming back, leading this vast army to wage war against those who are oppressing his people. And so then, do you see what James is saying here? Like, put all that together, right? You see what he's saying here? Not only this first century readers who he's writing to, but also to us. He's saying, yes, I know that life is hard. I know that you're in pain. I know you hurt. I know it's difficult. I know that you're suffering and being oppressed and defrauded. I know all that, but guess what? Be patient. Be patient. Wait. Why? Because there's coming a day in which Jesus is going to return back to this earth. And when he does, he's going to judge those who are oppressing you. And he's going to deliver you from all the hurt and all the pain and all the suffering that you're enduring in this life right now. In the rest of verse 7 then, what James does is he gives this kind of common everyday example of what this sort of patient waiting looks like. So then look at the example he gives in the rest of verse 7 here. He says, "See how the farmer waits for precious fruit of the earth, being patient about it until it receives the early and the late rains." What he's talking about here, these early and late rains that he mentions here, usually came in the late fall and also in the early spring. So then the farmer then, you would imagine what he would do. He would plant his crops, but then he would have to wait. He'd have to patiently wait after he planted his crops to wait for those rains, the early and the late rains to come, before his crops would get rain and before his crops would bear any fruit. And James here is saying that just as a farmer patiently has to wait for these rains to come, for the crops to bear fruit, so those who are suffering, we who are suffering, also have to patiently wait. And do you see what we're waiting for? We're not waiting necessarily for our suffering to go away in this life, for that relationship to be reconciled and restored, for that physical pain in our body to somehow just automatically go away, for the sorrow to stop, for the pain to stop. That's not what he tells us or them to be patient and to wait for. Instead, what we're patiently waiting for is the coming of the Lord, when the Lord finally and ultimately comes to vindicate us, to maybe judge those who are oppressing and defrauding you, and to deliver you from the suffering and the pain and the heartache that you're experiencing in this life. But think about that, right? Again, waiting is hard. Being patient is hard. It's especially hard when you're in pain, right? Isn't it hard to wait when you're in pain? It's hard to wait when you're hurting. It's in those moments, in those moments in our lives, that it's most difficult to wait. It's most difficult to be patient. And the reality is, some of y'all here, y'all been waiting for a long, 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 long time. You've been waiting for a long time for that pain in your body to leave. You've been waiting a long time for that relationship to finally be restored. You've been waiting a long time for the sorrow and the pain and the heartache in your heart and the tears flowing down your cheeks to go away and to stop. You've been waiting a long time. And if that's you, if you've been waiting a long time for all of that, for deliverance and rescue from all of the pain and the suffering in the midst of your trials, then here's what James tells us here, and I've said this over and over again. Some of y'all can probably quote this. That the suffering you're going through right now may last the rest of your life, but you can be rest assured it's not going to last forever. It's not going to last forever. Instead, there's coming a day in which Jesus is going to return back to this earth, and he's going to end your suffering, like once and for all. Like if you're being mistreated right now, if you're being oppressed right now, if you're being taken advantage of right now, abused right now, violated right now, like these Jewish Christians that James is writing to, then know this.
Jesus sees you. He hears your cry. And one day, he's going to come to your defense. He's going to vindicate you. And he's going to pour out his wrath and judgment against those who sinned against you. Like, that day is coming, so be patient. Be patient. Wait. Or if you're suffering in other ways, physically, relationally, emotionally, whatever else, Jesus sees you too. He hears your cry too. And you can be rest assured that one day he too is going to come back to this earth and deliver you from all the hurt and the pain and the sorrow and the suffering that you're facing in your life. So what? So be patient. Wait. Endure. Remain steadfast. That day is coming. It then leads to the second way we're to patiently endure suffering in our lives. And the second way is this: it's to stand firm as you patiently wait for the Lord's return. To stand firm as you patiently wait for the Lord's return. That's what James goes on to say next there in verse 8. Look there with me at verse 8. He repeats what he just said in verse 7, the very beginning of verse 8. He says, "You also be patient." Meaning, just like that farmer's patient, you also be patient. Then he says this: "Establish your hearts, for the coming of the Lord is at hand." That word "establish" there means to stand firmly and fixed in place. To stand firmly and fixed in place and not move. To not budge. It means to be resolute. It means to be firmly established and planted and fixed somewhere. But you don't waver, you don't move, you don't even budge an inch. So it's the picture of like my basketball goal at home, right? So big, violent thunderstorms come through. Wake up the next morning. I've got yard furniture and chairs strung out all over the backyard on the deck. I've got tree limbs, small tree limbs, big tree limbs all over my front yard, and all sorts of other debris all over the yard in the front and in the back. But guess what's not on the ground? My basketball goal. My basketball goal. And you know why it's not on the ground? Because it's firmly planted in concrete. It's fixed. It's established in the concrete, in the ground. And so then even when the violent winds come and the violent storms come, huge, massive tree limbs fall, yard furniture flies, other debris flown all over the place, but not that basketball goal that's firmly fixed and planted in the ground. And that's the picture that James is painting here. That the picture that he's painting here and the exhortation that he's giving here and how we're to respond to the suffering that we face in our lives. That he's telling his readers, yes, I know you're being oppressed. Yes, I know you're being abused. Yes, I know you're being defrauded by these wealthy landowners. But in the midst of it all, stand firm. Be firmly planted. Be fixed in place. Don't waver. Don't waver in your faith. Don't waver in your walk with Jesus. Instead, stand firm and fixed in the midst of the suffering that you're walking through in your life. But again, this is hard. Like, this isn't always easy. Like think about this just practically for your life right now. I mean, think about the specific suffering that you're walking through, specific trial that you're walking through right now in your life. And ask yourself, what ways am I most tempted in the midst of the suffering that I'm walking through, in the midst of the trials that I'm walking through, what ways am I most tempted to waver? Am I most tempted to waver in my faith, to waver in my walk with Jesus? In what ways am I tempted in the midst of this trial to waver and to compromise my holiness? In the midst of this suffering, to compromise my walk with Jesus? And so for some, that might look like running to things to numb yourself from the pain of the suffering that you're walking through. To numb yourself, to escape from the suffering and the trial that you're walking through in your life. So you escape to binge watching TV shows. You escape to social media. You escape to pornography. You escape to misusing alcohol. You escape to not bad things, maybe just good things. But you look to those things to be your refuge, to be your God, to be your safety and security in times of trial and difficulty. Other ways you might waver in times of trial or suffering might be involving just your heart attitudes, allowing your heart attitudes of bitterness or anger or unforgiveness or fear or anxiety begin to cultivate in your heart. Other ways you might begin to waver is just isolating yourself from community, isolating yourself from friendships, isolating yourself from the church and biblical community in the midst of trials and suffering. For others, it might be you just give up reading the Word, and you might give up praying just because God, you feel like God's being mean to you. So you don't want to spend any time with Him. Like, the last thing I want to do is minimize anybody's hurt and pain and suffering that you're walking through right now. But in what ways do you struggle to stand firm? In what ways do you waver when it comes to your walk with Jesus, your holiness, your faith as you walk through trials? How do the winds of trials toss you to and fro and cause you to waver in your faith? Like, if that's you, look at the motivation then that James gives us for why we're to establish our hearts, for why we're to stand firm and remain firmly planted in the midst of the suffering and the trials we face in our lives. Look at the motivation he gives us at the rest of verse 8. Look what he says. He says, establish your hearts, or stand firm, stand in place. Why? He says, for, so here's the reason we're to do that, for the coming of the Lord is at hand. Those words there, those last three words, is at hand, literally can be translated as near. It's near, meaning it's approaching, it's drawing near, it's imminent, it's getting really, really, really close. And do you see then how the reality of that then should motivate us to stand firm and to remain firmly planted in our faith and to not waver in the midst of suffering? It motivates us because it reminds us that we're not going to have to suffer forever. Instead, the end of our suffering is near. It's getting closer. It's drawing near. Like, I don't know when that's going to happen, obviously. I don't know if that's going to happen in your lifetime, in my lifetime, or when. But we're getting closer to it. It's imminent. It's near. In terms of salvation history and redemptive history, it's what happens next. The Lord comes. His coming is at hand. Have you ever been in pain, just waiting for that pain to be done with? I remember, some of y'all have heard this story. I can't believe I'm sharing this publicly. Second time I ever had a kidney stone. We're visiting my parents down in Oklahoma. It's about 3:00 in the morning. I'm laying in bed. Amy's in bed. And then all of a sudden, just feels like a sword is stuck right in the back, my lower back. And I just hop out of bed. I go straight to the bathroom. Just fall on my hands and knees in that bathroom. I'm not going to give you a picture of this. Just dry heaving, sweating profusely, thinking I'm going to die. Just dying. And then I tell Amy, just go get my dad. Go get my dad. And the reason I need to go get my dad is because he knew where the hospital was, okay? And so I'm like, go get my dad. Just go get my dad. Just get me to the hospital. Get me to the hospital. And so she was gone like for 7 hours. right? Or that's what it felt like. It felt like 7 hours. In reality, it was like 7 seconds. But then she finally gets back, and I say, and this is me and my hurt, my pain, my suffering. I look at her, and I say, I didn't take you this long to get you to the hospital when you were pregnant, all right? And so that wasn't good. I apologized to her. That was bad, not good, right? But in the midst of pain, like I just like get me to the hospital. But when I knew the hospital was a long way away, the pain increased. It increased. Get me to the hospital. But when she finally got back, it's like, hey, we're about to go to the hospital. Like the hospital's drawing near. That pain shot is drawing near. It allowed me to persevere and endure that pain because I know it wasn't going to last very long because that pain shot is getting closer. That's the picture here. Suffering, trials, sorrow, heartache, pain. You can stand firm. You can endure. You can remain steadfast in your faith and in your holiness, your walk with Jesus. Why? Because the Lord is drawing near.
Third way we're to patiently endure suffering is this. It's to not grumble against others as you patiently wait for the Lord's return. Don't grumble against others as you patiently wait for the Lord's return. This is what James goes on to say in the very next verse there in verse 9. Look there, he says in verse 9, don't grumble against one another, brothers. So I don't know about you, but kind of reading through, just following James' logical flow of thought up to this point in verse 9, you're like, where'd that come from, James? Kind of seems out of place. Like, it would have made sense if James would have told them, don't grumble against the Lord in the midst of your suffering, right? That would have made sense because they could conceive why they'd be tempted to grumble against the Lord. Or it would have made sense if he would have said, don't grumble against those rich, wealthy landowners who are oppressing you because they're causing you to suffer. So don't grumble against them. Don't grumble against the Lord. Don't grumble against the rich, wealthy landowners who are oppressing. Like, that would make sense. He doesn't say any of these, either of those. He says, don't grumble against one another. Like, why in the world would they be grumbling against one another? That's not the beef. They don't have an issue with one another. They have an issue with the Lord and with those who are oppressing them. So, what's he saying here? Well, I'm not 100% sure, to be honest with you. So we're going to bring in Douglas Moo, a New Testament scholar, who wrote a commentary on James, and this is what Douglas Moo says. He says, grumbling against those who are close to us is particularly likely to occur when we are under pressure or facing difficult circumstances. We vent the pressure from a stressful work environment or from ill health on our close friends and family. So it would be quite natural if James's readers, under the pressure of poverty and persecution and oppression, would turn their frustrations on one another. And we can all relate to this, right? Like, life is hard, life is difficult. So who do you let it out on? Your spouse, your roommate, your kids. You're frustrated at work, you have pain and hurt because of something at work, and you bring that home, and you let it out on them. You pour out all your frustration and anger out on them. You're stressed out, you're overwhelmed, so others get to bear the brunt of your anger and your frustration. So you're short with people, you're exasperated by others, you grumble and complain against others as if they're the problem. But the reality is, you're the problem. That's just how you're responding to the hurt and the pain and the difficulty and the suffering that you're walking through in your life. You're letting it out on others. And this is, look how why James tells us not to do this. Look at the warning or the motivation he gives for why we shouldn't grumble against others in the midst of our suffering. Look at the rest of verse 9. He says, so that you may not be judged. Behold, the judge is standing at the door. And so again, James is once again talking about what? Jesus' return. 3 verses, 3 times, he talks about Jesus' return. This time he talks about it
in reference to him being the judge who's standing at the door about ready to return in judgment. But this time in verse 9, he doesn't bring up Jesus' return in order to encourage us in our suffering like he did in verse 7 and verse 8. Instead, he brings up Jesus' return in order to warn us and keep us from grumbling and complaining against each other when we suffer, so that we're not judged by him when he returns. And this is really important to remember when it comes to suffering. And we've talked about this before. But so often when we suffer and when we walk through trials, we can feel like we have a free pass to say whatever we want and to treat people however we want to, because life is hard, life is difficult, and so somehow I have a free pass to say whatever I want to and treat people however I want to because I'm suffering, you know. That's not true. Instead, God still holds us accountable for our words and for how we treat people, for grumbling and complaining against people, even when life is really, really hard and challenging. And that's what we see here in verse 9. And so then, what do we do? Like, think about that in your life. What are times that you find that to be true of you? Grumbling, letting out your frustrations, complaining against others in the midst of your suffering, turning your frustrations, turning your anger on others when you're walking through trials and difficulties in your life. What does that look like for you? Who gets the brunt of your frustrations and anger in those times? James exhorts us, don't grumble against others. Don't complain against others in our suffering. Fourth, final way we patiently endure ongoing suffering in our lives is this. It's to remember the example and outcome of others who have patiently endured suffering in their lives. Remember the example and outcome of others who have patiently endured suffering in their lives. This is what James goes on to say in the very last two verses there in chapter 5 there in verses 10 and 11. Look there with me. In these final two verses, what he's going to do is he's going to give two Old Testament examples of two examples from the Old Testament of people who suffered greatly, but who patiently endured and remained steadfast in the midst of the suffering that they encountered. And the first example he gives from the Old Testament is that of the prophets, the Old Testament prophets. So we see this in verse 10. Look there with me at verse 10. James says, "As an example of suffering and patience, brothers, take the prophets who spoke in the name of the Lord." So James here doesn't tell us specifically the specific names of the prophets that he's thinking of here, but he's probably referring to or thinking about prophets like Elijah, who, if you remember, was harassed and pursued and persecuted by King Ahab and Jezebel. Or he's thinking about the prophet Jeremiah, who is known as, what was his nickname? The Weeping Prophet, right? Talk about somebody who suffered. Is nicknamed the Weeping Prophet because he was beaten, he was put in stocks, he was thrown into a dungeon, and then after he was thrown into a dungeon, he was thrown into a cistern. Or you might be thinking about prophets like Daniel, who was torn from his homeland, if you remember, and thrown into a den of lions. And many, he's probably thinking about many other prophets as well. Prophets who suffered, who lost a lot, who were nicknamed weeping prophets, who encountered a whole lot of pain and difficulty and suffering in their lives. Yet they patiently endured. They suffered with great patience and they remained steadfast. The other example then he gives us in verse 11 is the example of Job. And we see this in verse 11. Look what he says. James says, "Behold, we consider those blessed who remained steadfast." Then he gives, in the rest of verse 11, he gives an example of someone who remained steadfast and therefore was blessed by God because they remained steadfast in the midst of suffering. He says, here's the example he gives, in the rest of verse 11, "You have heard of the steadfastness of Job." So most of us know the story of Job, right? Just think of this, right? It's just not a story. It's not just some made-up story. Like this was a real man who lived at a real time in history, who had real children and a real wife and a real family, and all this happened to him. Like, really. In one day, all 10 of his children died. One day, just all gone. All died. That same day, all of his possessions, every single last one of his possessions, completely destroyed. Just all destroyed. His body, his whole body from the crown of his head to the bottom of his feet, filled with just these oozing sores. His reputation in the community, completely tarnished, completely ruined. Everybody thought he was righteous. Then they see what happened to him. Now they think he's wicked. His sense of God's presence in his life and God being with him, and God being present with him, completely gone. Doesn't sense the presence of God in his life at all. But Job's life was hard. It's painful. He suffered. And in the midst of that, if you remember the story of Job, he cried, he wept, he lamented, he questioned God about 100 things, and it's hard. But through it all, through all his loss, through all his tears, through all his questions, through all his lament, he remained steadfast. And he patiently endured. And he ended up blessing God rather than cursing God. And he said, though he slay me, I will still hope in him. And as a result of that, then, we know the rest of Job's story, right? We know the end of Job's story then, right? James tells us at the very end of verse 11 here. Look there with me. He says, and you have seen the purpose of the Lord, how the Lord is compassionate and merciful. The word purpose there is translated in most translations as the word end, E-N-D. The word end. And that's probably a word purpose isn't a bad translation, but the word end probably brings out more of what James is getting at here. It's a reference to the end of Job's story. The end that the Lord brought about in Job's story. In other words, suffering wasn't the ultimate end of Job's story. Instead, the Lord showing compassion, the Lord showing mercy to Job and restoring everything he had taken from Job was God's end of Job's story. And this is good news for us. Like if you're here this morning and you're a Christian, then the same thing that was true of Job is going to be ultimately true of you. Like suffering, whatever you're going through, isn't the end of God's story for you. Your pain isn't the end of God's story for you. Your tears and sorrow and heartache isn't the end of God's story for you. Instead, the end of God's story for you, the end of God's story that He's writing for your life, doesn't end with suffering. It's not you cried, the end. You lost this, the end. That's not the end of God's story that He's writing for you. Instead, the end of God's story for you involves a compassionate, merciful God restoring to you everything that you lost in your suffering, just like He did with Job. That doesn't mean, this is really important, that doesn't mean He's going to restore it all back in this life, here on this earth, just like He did with Job. But it does mean that you're going to get it all back, and even better, and even more, when Jesus returns and ushers in the new creation and makes all things new. And the reality of that then, I know, doesn't remove or take away the suffering and the heartache that you're facing and walking through in this life right now. But it does remind us that our suffering has an expiration date. And it reminds us to fix our eyes, not just on the things that we've lost here on this earth, but to fix our eyes on our hope, on the return of Jesus, and on the compassion and the mercy that's going to be lavished upon us when Jesus returns and restores back everything that we've lost in this life when we suffered and walked through trials. But here's the deal. The only reason any of that is possible is because of Jesus. The only reason any of what I just described is possible is because of Jesus. In other words, since Jesus perfectly endured the suffering he faced, then he's the means and the reason for why we're able to patiently endure the suffering that we face in this life. And here's how. That when Jesus was on this earth, he suffered. Make no mistake about it. He was beaten. He was mocked. He was belittled. He was killed. He was shamed on a cross. And in the midst of it all, in the midst of all the suffering that came his way, what did he do? He patiently endured. He patiently waited. He stood firm. He stood fast. He didn't grumble or complain to anyone. Instead, he remained steadfast. And he did so all the way to his final breath on the cross, where he took the punishment that you and I deserve for all the times that we haven't remained steadfast and all the ways we haven't patiently endured the suffering that we walked through in our life. That Jesus patiently endured and took the punishment for all of that. And not only that, but his perfect record of patient endurance and steadfastness has been credited to us, has been credited to all those who have placed their faith and trust in him as if we perfectly endured. But guess what? He didn't stay dead. Instead, 3 days later, he rose back from the dead as the first fruits of the new creation, which will usher in then when he returns. Like all of that, all of it, like Jesus' perfect life credited to us, Jesus' substitutionary death in our place, Jesus' victorious resurrection, Jesus' future return to usher in the new creation, like all of that is ours. Like this isn't a sermon of like a halftime coach's speech. Oh, just go get them. Grin and bear it. Pull up your bootstraps. Endure. Fight. Play four quarters. You can do it. That's not what this sermon is. Instead, the only reason and the only means we have to patiently endure is Jesus. It's because he patiently endured as our representative for us. He patiently endured all the way to the cross to take the judgment for all the ways we haven't patiently endured. He rose from the dead in victory and is returning back to this earth to usher in a new creation that we're patiently enduring and waiting for. All of it, from beginning to end, of our patience is a result of and is motivated by Jesus and his perfect patient endurance for us. And since Jesus patiently endured, in the midst of the suffering that he faced, we have hope now and a reason to patiently endure in the midst of the suffering that we face in this life as well. Let me pray. Lord, thank you for speaking into the hard, difficult areas of our lives, the times of trials and difficulties and heartache and sorrow and pain. Thank you that you see us, that you hear our cry, and that you're going to do something about it. Thank you that as we're waiting patiently, that you are with us. We don't just have to wait until then, but you're with us now to sustain us now, to comfort us now, to encourage us right now. We're not alone right now. But thank you for what we're waiting for. That as we look to that day, and as we look to the future day, and the eternity that awaits us, help us by your Spirit to be hopeful, to be patient, to not waver, to remain steadfast. Like Paul says in Romans 8:18, that to realize that our present affliction, the present affliction that we're walking through in this life, pales in comparison to our future glory to come. And I pray that that future glory would compel us to hang on, to hold on tight, and to wait expectantly with hope for that day. We pray all this in Jesus' name. Amen.